the stronger we are on our policies in Alaska, the stronger we can be in leading the Arctic Council.
The president issues an executive order coordinating activity in the Arctic. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, January 21st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, deciding the future of the Tongass National Forest.
We want to see the Forest Service redirect its budget to prioritize the industries that most Southeast Alaskans depend on.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Enroll now in the health insurance marketplace. Sign up at healthcare.gov. Open enrollment ends February 15th. Depending on your income, age, and family size, you may be eligible for discounts that may lower your monthly costs and out-of-pocket expenses. Pick a plan that is right for you and your family. Call 211 for free individual assistance about the health insurance marketplace. Visit getcoveredalaska.org for more information. This message sponsored by Ashna, a partner of Get Covered Alaska.
President Barack Obama today issued an executive order aimed at coordinating federal action on the Arctic. The order establishes a new Arctic Executive Steering Committee. It will have some 24 members, including deputy secretaries from the Departments of State, Defense, Homeland Security, and Interior. Among the stated goals is better collaboration with the state of Alaska and Alaska tribes. Marilyn Hyman, a former Alaska advisor to the Interior Secretary, now works on Arctic conservation for the Pew Charitable Trusts. Hyman says the new steering committee could be useful.
You'd be amazed at how many people work and how many agencies work on the Arctic. And having, you know, one place where all the issues are addressed and the agencies are convened to discuss the issues, I think will help.
The order is part of the federal government's preparations for assuming chairmanship of the International Arctic Council this spring. Hyman says the work will only be successful if the U.S. develops good standards for things like Arctic drilling and shipping.
Other countries look to the United States for leadership. And the stronger we are on our policies in Alaska, the stronger we can be in leading the Arctic Council.
Senator Lisa Murkowski faintly praises the executive order's promise of consultation with Alaskans, but she says Washington-based environmental groups have too much sway. Murkowski says President Obama's Arctic policy boils down to two words, hands off. Governor Bill Walker is set to deliver his first State of the State address tonight. It's the first of two back-to-back speeches he'll give this week on his legislative priorities, with tomorrow's focus purely on the budget. In the lead-up, legislators are laying out their expectations for what such an address should include. Representative Mike Hawker, an Anchorage Republican, took to the House floor this morning to encourage Walker to describe his plan for the development of a natural gas mega project that would get reserves on the North Slope to market.
I truly hope that we hear words that assuage the fears that are being expressed on Wall Street about our willingness to work with them to mitigate the risks and keep a pipeline project going.
The project is expected to cost at least $45 billion, and lawmakers view its construction as a way to help bolster the state's lagging revenues. Representative Les Guerra, an Anchorage Democrat, would like the governor to explain how education will be treated as the state faces a multi-billion dollar shortfall.
You know, I think if he outlined ways that we can protect families, protect schools, protect public safety, and focus on finding government waste, cutting some of these $15 to $20 billion worth of non-priority capital projects.
Walker will give his address at 7 p.m. Alaska Board of Fisheries Chairman Carl Johnstone resigned yesterday after Governor Bill Walker said he wouldn't submit his name to the legislature for reappointment. KSTK's Katarina Sestarek reports.
Board of Fisheries Chairman Carl Johnstone's resignation comes after the board blocked a candidate for Fish and Game Commissioner from being interviewed for the position. Governor Walker's press secretary, Grace Jang, says only one of four candidates was interviewed by the Board of Fisheries and Board of Game. That was Acting Commissioner Sam Cotton.
Governor Walker was very disappointed that the process wasn't allowed to play out and that only one name was advanced to him.
A candidate rejected by the Board of Fisheries, Roland Ma, may replace Johnstone on the board. Governor Walker nominated Ma to fill the vacancy, but the legislature has to approve the appointment. Johnstone says he voted to reject an interview with Ma because of his history with the Board of Fisheries. He says Ma is part of a lawsuit to put some state-managed salmon fisheries under federal management.
That was the clincher, a deal killer for me, because I believe in the state should manage its own resources.
Rather than wait for his term to expire in June, Board Chairman Johnstone says he volunteered to step down this month to help Governor Walker get a new member on board faster. Johnstone will officially resign after this week's board meeting in Wrangell. Reporting in Wrangell, I'm Katarina Sestarek.
The Bering Sea's largest fishery kicked off yesterday. Pollock crews are gearing up for a potential increase in their harvest, while still keeping an open mind about what the winter has in store. KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports.
Within hours of arriving in Unalaska on Tuesday morning, the crew of the Sea Dawn was back to work.
We'll just get everything on the boat, and then we can start organizing it.
Ron Mitchell is stacking extra nets on deck using a crane. Once they start fishing, the Sea Dawn and the other vessels in the Unisea Cooperative will have a little extra pollock to work with, too. The catch limit increased about 3% this year to 1.3 million metric tons. And one of their biggest expenses has been getting cheaper. Mitchell says he's keeping an eye on the cost of fuel.
We're hoping to make a little more money since fuel prices are down, but then we heard the fish prices are down, too.
Up in the wheelhouse, Captain Richard Wyatt is a little more optimistic.
Initial reports on prices aren't so exciting to us, but you can make up a little bit of that if fishing's good, so we'll just see where it goes.
According to studies from the National Marine Fisheries Service, the amount of pollock in the Bering Sea is on the rise. That's part of the reason why this year's catch limit went up. But other fish aren't faring so well. Halibut have been getting smaller and harder to find, and the harvests have been shrinking too. That's prompted Alaska's acting Fish and Game Commissioner and others to file an emergency petition. They want a stricter limit on the amount of halibut the trawlers are allowed to take on accident while they're pursuing other fish, including pollock. NIMS is still considering that request. But in the meantime, biologist Kristen Milani says the same bycatch limits will apply.
Everything's managed by sectors and co-ops, and so they kind of self-manage their caps, and we definitely are looking at any kind of incidental catch that they're coming across, prohibited species that they're catching, and we'll be watching their reports when they come in.
The first round and the first deliveries of pollock are expected early next week. In Unalaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the National Park Service considers banning pack animals from Alaska parks.
My wife and I have been using llamas as pack animals in Alaska, including the national parks, for over 30 years.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Over the years, Alaskans like you have donated over $10 million to nonprofit organizations benefiting everything from Alaska's youth to the arts to healthcare. You've even donated to public radio to keep quality programming alive and well in Alaska. So come on, Alaska, warm your heart by sharing your PFD. Pick, click, give. This message on Alaska Public Media comes from ExxonMobil, BP Alaska, and Alaska Mental Health Trust.
The Tongass Advisory Committee is meeting for the fifth time in Juneau this week. The committee is tasked with hammering out how the Forest Service should handle the Obama administration's transition away from old-growth logging to a new focus on younger trees. But as KCAW's Rachel Waldholtz reports, for some people, the most important questions are the ones the committee isn't supposed to address.
If you want to know what it feels like to be on the Tongass Advisory Committee, the key word seems to be risky. Here's committee member Wade Zammit, former president of the Sealaska Timber Corporation, speaking at the last meeting in Sitka.
This is kind of the moderate group, and that was by design, and I know that. But there's tremendous pressure by every single person sitting at this table from influences in their constituency about the direction they need to take this. And that applies to, that's risk. I mean, they are out on the limb on some of the things we're about to tackle.
Those things include how quickly the Forest Service will taper off old growth timber sales and how quickly it can ramp up sales of younger second growth trees. The Tongass Committee is made up of over a dozen representatives from timber, fishing, and conservation groups, local communities, and native organizations. The committee is supposed to come up with recommendations for the upcoming amendment to the Tongass Forest Plan by late February, though they've asked for more time. That forest plan is a sort of zoning map for the entire Tongass, essentially what can happen where. And for now, everyone agrees on one thing. The current situation is untenable. For the timber industry, lawsuits have made it impossible to get sales out on any reliable timeline, while for conservationists, there's still too much old growth slated for logging. And for communities across Southeast, the long, slow decline of the timber industry has left a major economic hole.
I think everybody recognizes that we can't just flip a switch and immediately begin to bring second growth online.
That's Undersecretary of Agriculture Robert Bonney, who attended the last committee meeting in Sitka.
That's because there's not a whole lot of second growth out there, and because there's some constraints on the Forest Service's ability to do that. What we'd like to do is, over time, decrease the amount of old growth timber and increase the amount of second growth, and that's the opportunity here. Now, the faster we do that from a standpoint of the conflicts we've seen, the better. But we also have to give the industry time to adapt.
Meanwhile, fishing and recreation groups want more attention from the Forest Service. During public comments at the committee's last meeting, people said over and over again that the Forest Service and the committee need to move beyond a single-minded focus on timber.
We want to see the Forest Service redirect its budget to prioritize the industries that most Southeast Alaskans depend on.
Melena Marvin is the executive director of the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council.
Everything related to salmon, you know, commercial fishing, sport fishing, subsistence, personal use, and visitor industries, tourism. Those are our economic powerhouses. And so many people really feel that those should be the focus of Tongass management.
A recent report from Raincoast Data found that in 2013, the timber industry directly employed 325 people in Southeast Alaska. Together, the seafood and tourism industries employed nearly 11,000 people. So, commenters asked, why is there a special committee to address timber industry needs and not for fishing or recreation? Joel Hansen is with the Boat Company, which runs small cruise ships in Southeast.
And I just want to let you know that we at the Boat Company feel both irrelevant to the process and threatened by it, and that's not a good place for us to be. So, for those of you who are hoping the TAC will bring about some changes which might actually reduce the amount of controversy over timber sales in the Tongass and result in fewer lawsuits, I'd suggest you either don't get your hopes up or try like hell right now to figure out some way to reduce the threat this transition process poses to recreational interests.
I think we understand that criticism.
Bonney said the Tongass Committee's charter is deliberately narrow.
But I think it's also important to recognize that we need to move to a place around forest management where there's more of a shared vision around what that looks like.
In other words, Bonney said, timber is the most controversial piece of the Tongass puzzle. And the Forest Service worries that giving the committee too much to do might undermine its ability to get anything done at all. In Sitka, I'm Rachel Waldholz.
Alaska Pacific University has entered into an agreement to develop 65 acres of endowment lands over the next several years in Anchorage. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
The first parcels of land under development will be on the south side of the campus along University Lake Drive. Ideally, APU President Don Bant says the development will bring in organizations that connect with the university's curriculum, but it's still open for discussion.
We're obviously looking for highest and best use in terms of commercial development, but we're amenable to things like, restaurants or mixed-use commercial. So that's all this part of the plan. I want to stress first, though, that we're going to develop this for a campus feel. In other words, everything's going to be aesthetically consistent, and it will look like a campus. So it won't be just a mishmash of, buildings here and there.
Because APU doesn't receive state funding, Bant says agreements like this help to develop the university's financial future and long-term sustainability.
It's really a way to make private quality education available to all Alaskans. So this is how we discount our tuition for the income that will be generated from these properties.
At the beginning of the 2014 school year, APU cut tuition costs by about a third to around $19,500 per year. Bant says aside from allowing for lower tuition rates, the development will help the university sustain a robust scholarship program, which he says the majority of the school's 600 students benefit from. APU's plan has been developed independently of the controversial Northern Access Project, which would connect Elmore Road and Burgaw Street by cutting through a swath of the UMed District's woods and wetlands between APU and the University of Alaska Anchorage. The Northern Access Project has been widely criticized by surrounding communities. Carolyn Ramsey is an area resident and APU alum. She says, much like the road extension, this development would be detrimental to the university's students.
Many of the students use the APU campus as their giant petri dish, where they go to get their data, to get their information, to count the flora and fauna, to do what they need to do as an environmental teaching school.
Though Ramsey understands that it's APU's land to make use of, she's still disappointed in the university's decision.
APU did not come to the council or come to the community at large and say, hey, you know, we have a lot of land here. We need to do something with it. We need to generate some money. Is there any way that you could help us?
Bant says the university recognizes the community's concern over how both of these projects will affect the surrounding green space and trail system.
We're committed to the trail system, and if the development impacts that trail system, which the road may do a little, we're committed to replace the trail.
If the Northern Access Project goes through, Bant says it could affect development plans on the west side of the APU campus. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, announcing the 2015 Board of Directors election, which began on January 21st, encouraging early bird proxy submission by Friday, February 13th. Information at doyon.com.
Alaska Pacific University is proud to announce the APU Promise Tuition Grant, a program designed to significantly minimize or eliminate out-of-pocket tuition expenses for Pell-eligible students. Deadline to apply is March 1, 2015. Alaska Pacific University, a private nonprofit committed to personalized experiential learning that incorporates Alaska as its principal classroom. More at 1-800-252-7528. This message is sponsored by APU. Buckets of rain blew into Ketchikan yesterday and today, leading to power outages, flooded streets, and evacuations. KRBD's Layla Carey has more.
The National Weather Service warned us, and they weren't kidding. Heavy rain combined with strong wind gusts created some problems in Ketchikan. On Park Avenue, Police Chief Alan Bengard was checking out the raging Ketchikan Creek, and he summed up the issue.
It's raining really heavy, and there's a lot of water.
Now, Ketchikan residents are used to a lot of rain, and the creek has flooded out some areas before. But longtime residents agreed this is the highest they've ever seen it. Here's Sheila Miller, who's lived in Ketchikan all her life and was working at Parnassus Bookstore close to Ketchikan Creek.
I have never seen it out of the banks like it was up on Park Avenue, and it's up, you know, touching the Eagles Club there. I've never seen it that high, no. They've closed the bridge and the boardwalk, anything on pilings, so, and evacuated the buildings behind us. Never seen or heard of that being done before.
Does that make you nervous?
Not right here, but nervous for the other people.
One of those people is Ray Troll. He owns Soho Coho, an art gallery on Creek Street. He was anxiously watching the creek water as the current raged against the boardwalk in front of his store.
Totally freaked out, but I kind of knew this day would come someday with the creek shall rise, and it has risen. Big storm, big tide, bad combo.
Oh yeah, part of the problem was a 19-foot high tide, which was cresting as Troll watched.
I've never seen it this high. I've been here for 30 plus years, so no, I've never seen it this high. And like I said, I've been watching it. We've had our gallery down here for 20 plus years, so.
Yeah. And, I assume you have flood insurance.
There's still half an hour to buy some, isn't there?
Troll later reported that his store survived high tide. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
The National Park Service is out with an annual list of temporary restrictions and rules, and as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, one of the proposed regulations would ban certain types of pack animals from parks.
The National Park Service is proposing a ban on domestic goats, sheep, llamas, alpacas, and related animals from Alaska parks. Park Service Associate Regional Director for Natural Resources Deborah Cooper says the issue arose following an incident in Denali National Park last summer.
A pack goat traveling on trails in Denali. And that was one of the first reports that we've had.
Cooper says domesticated farm animals pose a disease threat to wildlife.
The domestic animals, particularly sheep and goats, carry respiratory diseases, pneumonia, a number of parasites, and eczema, some other things that are very, very contagious and can knock out wild sheep and goat populations very quickly.
Cooper says that happened to some populations in the lower 48 decades ago, and the potential impact in Alaska now is higher.
Wild goats and sheep in Alaska are believed to be free of these diseases and have very low resistance to many of the livestock diseases. And we're not just talking about one disease. There is a whole host that are normally carried by domestic sheep and goats, as well as llamas and cattle, that can wipe out local populations or have a fairly devastating impact.
She adds that direct contact between animals is not required for transmission of some diseases, which can remain viable in fecal matter in the soil for an extended time. Trekking with animals other than horses is not a popular activity in Alaska, but there are a few enthusiasts.
My wife and I have been using llamas as pack animals in Alaska, including the national parks, for over 30 years.
Philip Nichterlein of Eagle River says he and his wife have primarily packed with llamas in Wrangell-St. Elias National Park, but have also been to Gates of the Arctic National Park and Preserve. Nichterlein specifically takes issue with the proposed prohibition on llamas, alpacas, and other animals classified as South American camelids.
I've spoken with South American camelid experts on the subject of this disease transmission, and these camelid experts tell me that no one has ever documented the transmission of any disease from a llama to another species of animal, wild or domestic.
Nichterlein says he knows of no disease concern-related llama bans on public lands in the lower 48 and believes the Park Service is distorting the risk in Alaska.
If they're not concerned about horses, well, llamas are not ruminants either. So, see, they're lumping llamas in, and I think there's just misguided concerns.
Nichterlein notes that the Alaska Board of Game declined to include llamas in a 2012 domestic pack animal ban related to wild sheep, goat, and muskoxen hunts, finding the animals did not present a significant disease risk. The Park Service proposed ban is one of numerous regulations in annual compendiums or compilations of restrictions, which are currently out for public comment through February 15th, including at meetings around the state and via a public teleconference January 29th. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
A playwright has spent the past few years exploring the lives of Juneau's homeless population and the people who work with them. The result is the new play, A Lifetime to Master. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
About 3 years ago, Mary Ellefson was driving home from cross-country skiing with her son near the Mendenhall Glacier when she turned onto Backloop Road and noticed a young man staggering down the street. She stopped to help and found out he was homeless.
He was maybe 19 or 18, and I just remember he was really intoxicated. He had nowhere to go. It wasn't like, I'm going to do something, I'm on a plan. It was just like, I don't know anything about this.
That incident inspired Ellefson to learn more about homelessness in Juneau. Since moving to the city 24 years ago, she's worked on and written several plays for Perseverance Theater. Her latest, A Lifetime to Master, is based on nearly 60 interviews she did with people about Juneau's homeless situation.
People who have been homeless, people whose lives or jobs intersect with the homeless, a lot of members of our Juneau Coalition on Housing and Homelessness, people in the school district, friends. I've overheard people at coffee shops or on the streets.
While the play is about Juneau, Ellefson says its themes resonate beyond. The title comes from the tagline for the board game Othello, A Minute to Learn, A Lifetime to Master. Ellefson says a pastor she interviewed connected that phrase to the great commandment from the Bible, love thy neighbor as thyself. As she went about trying to understand homelessness in Juneau, she says she kept those two ideas in mind.
I learned that there's as many reasons for being homeless as there are people who are homeless, that the issues range from poverty and economics to family to community responsibility to substance abuse to, I think, a third of Americans are one paycheck away from homelessness to domestic violence. There's a lot of issues that overlap.
The main character in the play has Ellefson's name and guides the audience through her interviews.
It's really a lot of listening to a lot of stories that are rarely heard in our community, are very hard to hear, as well as some quite uplifting stories of those people whose lives are dedicated to helping people who don't have homes.
At first, the problem seemed straightforward.
We have 562 self-identified homeless people.
The cast of A Lifetime to Master runs through lines at a rehearsal in McFeeters Hall at the Church of the Holy Trinity in downtown Juneau. The walls are covered with tarps, and actors pop up from lumpy mattresses to say their lines.
Sometimes we have three families sleeping wall to wall in a tiny apartment.
There are 160.
Director Shona Strasser has been involved with A Lifetime to Master for 2 years, ever since she read an early draft of the play. She says it's the most powerful production she's ever been part of.
It's touching, and it's people we know and see, you know? Like, you're going to see people in this play that you would see on the street or at their job.
The Juneau Coalition on Housing and Homelessness estimates more than 500 residents of the city don't have a permanent roof over their heads. Strasser says the cast and crew hope the play sparks community discussions about homelessness and even inspires people to act.
It's in your face. This play is in your face. And I don't mean that in a bad way. It's the idea that you are in this community and that everybody is around you and you got to do something. Otherwise, you're turning your back on people.
M.K. McNaughton, who plays Mary, says it's sometimes easier to start conversations about issues like homelessness through art.
We mostly don't walk up to people on the street and launch into deep personal stories or ask intimate questions. So art provides that opportunity.
Michael Patterson lived on the streets from age 9 to 37 and was interviewed by Ellefson during her research. He says the play is just the tip of the iceberg for what homeless people go through every day, but it's full of truth nonetheless.
I think if we can allow this to really touch all of our hearts and come together closer as a community, you know, then we have a better chance of maybe finding a real working solution to finally do something about this problem.
Generator Theater Company is producing A Lifetime to Master. Ellefson also receives support from the Rasmussen Foundation, the Juneau Arts and Humanities Council, the Juneau Community Foundation, and several other local businesses and nonprofits. The play runs through January 25th at McFeeters Hall. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Katerina Sestarek in Wrangell, Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Rachel Waldholtz in Sitka, Layla Carey in Ketchikan, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Casey Kelly in Juneau. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the 2015 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence Program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com.
And by
Alaska Premier Dental Group, providing full-service dental care for the entire family with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Service information at smilealaska.com. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2015 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. If you're not covered by health insurance, you may be eligible for financial help with monthly premiums and out-of-pocket expenses. Open enrollment ends on February 15th. Sign up at healthcare.gov. Last year, 88% of Alaskans who enrolled received financial assistance. Compare plans and see if you qualify for financial assistance. Call 211 to get free local help. Visit getcoveredalaska.org for more information. This message sponsored by Ashna, a partner of Get Covered Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.